Welcome back, everyone.
It's Tuesday, November 8th, 2011. People keep coming in and out. There's another meeting going on upstairs, so, you know, we may have some walk-ins or not. So last week we just said the, you know, very basic tone. Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I should put in a plug now for anyone who's listening that we're having a benefit concert Saturday night, December 3rd. I can register for it at stanstreetshul.com. Should be absolutely fantastic. Steve Reich will be performing, I believe. Yeah, so...
Oh, I don't know if the show is just... I think
it's
performing.
Yeah, I think that's all part of the concert. And Maya Breiser, who's a well-known cellist. So if you happen to be listening, recommend everyone sign up because it should be fantastic. Thank you very much for the reminder to put in the plug. And now it's going to be up there all posterity. Anyway.
The music is
classical.
New classical music, like modern classical.
Yeah. All right. So tonight, now that we, you know, sort of set up last week, logical foundations about what we're doing here, like the difference between fact and faith. The next step of like trying to get the core of Judaism. Anyone want to actually take a step before I start putting stuff on the board?
Yeah. Well, I listened to the blog list a couple of days ago, and you. From what I remember, I had much more of a picture of what you were presenting as what fact is.
Yeah.
And less about faith in Judaism. Is that okay. Something that's going to develop?
In a sense, yes. The short answer is going to be anything that you have to believe, even though you can't prove it empirically or through any measurable matters. But things that you're going to have to accept as a priori givens. Right? So what are some of the, you know, well, I guess let's take, what's the one big one? Yeah, there you go. So Tanakh is going to be about belief in God. In contrast with that, the other thing that we're going to discuss today is particularly the relationship between God and Torah. Right. That's it. I can spell sometimes.
Yeah, that was what the teaser was for me about the faith, not being just totally... you know, something a priori, but something that you believe within a system.
Right.
Because you had spoken about studying Torah first, before, that there was primary over, you said something about having faith in Torah before faith in God.
Well, that's actually kind of what we're going to talk about today, the relationship with God. So when people look at the words God and Torah, right, everyone's going to, I think, most Jews are... All right, well, you know what? I'll say most Jews are going to agree that these are two core components.
Well, I thought you said users.
No. Well, users, you know, might work too.
That's a nice
What is the relationship between God and Torah? Not a trick question here.
Well, we get God through Torah.
Ah, there you go. So, the way you describe it is we get God through Torah. Want to explain that?
Well, since we, most of us have not been contacted, and really don't know what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about God that much, we get our encounter with God through the Torah, basically.
That is a very well said.
And what that encounter is probably a big subject of what we're talking about.
Absolutely. So that's, you know, one answer. It's not the answer I would have necessarily been expecting. What would be another, the other approach to the relationship between God and Torah?
The other way.
Which is?
That God gave you the Torah.
That God gives us the Torah. Which leads us into, as you see, this nice little circle that, you know, is going to flesh out over time. But it's, you know, nice that we have it up here to consider now. On one hand, God gives us the Torah. On the other hand, the only thing that we know about Torah is through God, which gives us a bit of circular reason. I want to start out first by going through some of the sources inside here. So we actually have some source sheets, right? So let's take start with source number one. Just a couple of biblical references. Yeah, I know we did this last week too, but it's a good one to do.
Am I doing it in Hebrew?
You can do it in Hebrew, but just read the English too for the ones who can't follow.
Okay, so Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim v'et haAretz v'haAretz hayatohu v'vohu v'choshech al pnei tehom.
All right. No, I know I included more here, but you got the general idea here, right? Just basic translations.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
Yeah, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So the first verse of the Bible assumes the existence of a God. Right there. Don't have any backstory about, how did God came into being, and get this into, more deep philosophical questions later. Bible assumes that God exists, and that not only does God exist, but God essentially created the world. Again, take source number 2. This is Exodus 24, verses 12 and 13.
And the Lord said unto Moses, "Come up to me into the mount, and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone, and a law, and commandments which I have written, that thou mayest teach them."
All right. Yeah, next one.
And Moses rose up, and his minister Joshua, and Moses went up into the mount of God.
Okay. What do you think's going on here? Just very basic, very general, not trick question.
In the first part, I mean, what you know about God is that he's the creator. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you said, it doesn't start from any backstory or anything like that. You know God by what he's doing over here, right?
You're jumping way ahead, but yes. you're absolutely right. You understand God by what you're doing. And in source number 2, you've got God telling Moses, "Come up to the mountain, I'm going to give you tablets of stone and a law, God's giving Moses these tablets on which you have God's will of stuff that you're supposed to do. Take the next source, number 3 on our sheets. This is Devarim, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 44-45.
Maybe this is a silly question, but is it that God wants Moses to be closer to him when he gives the law, or is it that he wants to commune only with Moses and not with the rest of the people? Or?
Oh, that's huge, huge midrashic thing, because the truth is you had Moses that went up, but at least initially was in front of the entire Jewish nation. So it's not, the whole role of Moses is the one who brings it down versus the entire nation as a whole. Huge lot written on that, but it's not as exclusivity as God only gives it to Moses and then no one else. Bible does make it a point that it is in front of the entire nation that got the revelation. And I know enough people that point out that it's one of the characteristics that makes Judaism different, in that the description of revelation is to the masses, not to a specific individual. Even though individuals do get revelation, this is a recording of a mass revelation. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So not a stupid question at all. So take source number 3.
Okay. But I guess what you were getting at by the first two is that we're told about God in the Torah, and then we have a description of God giving Torah to Moses. Is that what you're?
Yeah, pretty much.
Kind of like circular.
Exactly.
Okay. And this is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel. These are the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments which Moses spake unto the children of Israel after they came forth out of Egypt.
Okay, so you have Zot Zatar Asher Samoshev with Nathan Israel, a pasuk that I think we're all familiar with if you've ever been to a synagogue, you point to the Sefer Torah, and you're towards the end of the book in chapter 31 of Devarim, you've got verse 9, V'chtel Moshe Tatorah Zot Yitna L'Kohanim B'nei Levi Nisi Hanosi'im Et Aron Brit Hashem Bel Kol Zikni Yisrael. Moses wrote this law, delivered it unto the priests and the sons of Levi, which bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to all the elders of Israel. Fast forward to the end of the chapter, verse 24, V'ikechalot Moshe L'chtov Et Divrei Torah Zot Al Sefer Al Sefer Ad Tumam. It came to pass that Moses had made an end to the writing of the words of this law in the book until they were finished. Yitzav Moshe tel Levim nosei Aaron brit Hashem limor, and God commanded the Levites which bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, Lakoch et sefer Torah hazev samtem oto mitzad arun brit Hashem Elokeichem vayasham bechalei. Take this book of the law, put it beside the Ark of the Covenant, Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness against thee. Right? So not only does Moses go up, you know, have, you know, a revelation at Sinai, get something back from God, but there's, you know, whatever the Torah that he has written in book form passed along for safekeeping, well, not just for safekeeping, but also for future transmissions. King is also specifically told to have a safer Torah by him. Right? So based on what we've seen so far in the Torah, the, you know, assumptions are obviously one, that there is a God, and two, God gave this thing that we call the Torah, and, you know, this kind of goes off and gets passed down. One idea that I'd like to, you know, flesh out before we talk a little more about the circular reasoning is to just illustrate that the two things are by no means interdependent. Meaning, we're going to see in a second how you can have God, you know, or a belief in God that isn't contingent on the Bible at all. Kelly, turn the page. Take number, source number five. This is...
The thing about the covenant being a witness against the... That's in the sense of the text being, being a confirmation this is what God actually said.
The translation isn't that great, but in terms of V'yasham b'chala'ed, that it, you know, when it should be some sort of testimony or something to bear witness to is a sign of endurance. Meaning that it should endure.
Oh, I thought maybe because of the word, that word, covenant, was mentioned that, you know, to show that, you know, here are the clear terms of...
Right, well, you're reading it from the Sunday class, but you haven't gotten there. I mean, you're free to come. The truth is, there is going to be a bit of overlap eventually there. So, just to give, you know, in section two here, source number five, it is theoretically possible to have a belief in a God that's independent of Torah. And I just wanted to give one example. This is from a book called Brahmanism and Hinduism, or Religious Thought and Life in India. Go ahead, Kelly.
Well, the deepest thinkers, even at that early period, felt with ever-increasing intensity, was that a spirit, Atman, beyond the cognizance of sense, permeated and breathed through all material things. They thought them with awe of the same spirit vivifying their own bodies with the same breath of life of this mysterious presence enshrined in their own consciousness. Then they defined the same spirit with the divine afflatus thrilling through the imaginations of their own hymn composers with the spiritual of the hymns themselves, with the mystic powers inherent in the divine knowledge and prayer. This mysterious, all-pervading, vague spiritual power and presence, which was wholly unbound by limitations of personality and individuality, became at last a reality. This breath of life, Atman, received a name. They called it Brahman, nominative neuter, Brahma for the root, birth, which is to expand, because it expanded itself through all space. It was a pure essence which not only diffused itself everywhere, but constituted everything. Men, gods, and the visible world were merely its manifestations.
Just on this description of, you know, some universal spirit, right? Some of the descriptions, at least based on, you know, this explanation, it seems like any generic description of a god. If you examine, or at least from what I've seen, certain like New Age or, you know, New Thought things will all give some variance on this theme of some universal creative being, which you could very well just call God. Now, if you focus on, say, this model here, you know, God giving the Torah, even if you assume the existence of a God, or, you know, the existence of, you know, let's say a Brahman-ish type of God, then it doesn't necessarily follow that, you know, you actually have to go and, you know, keep the Torah or keep any organized religion from that matter. You can just believe in some universal spirit and can reasonably think that, well, all these different religions are just ancient traditions or ancient ways that people tried adapting to this really old idea. Right.
And organize their cultures. Not as a small...
No, but organize is the exact point here. I mean, even if you could find, you know, some scientists that believe in the existence of a God, that doesn't necessarily follow you believe in any specific organized religion. I mean, that assumes a whole lot of things that, you know, we'll talk about this more next week, that God has certain expectations of you and there are going to be certain consequences. Like, all of those are huge, huge assumptions that, you know, even just from this one example here, one doesn't necessarily follow from the other. So if you want to set things up from a functional basis where, you know, your dependency is going to be, well, God comes first, then God gives Torah. Yes, you know, one doesn't necessarily have to follow from the next. Even though, like, you really don't have much of a, you know, Torah without God. The, yeah, and I have to say, the scariest thing is, that's not even the weirdest request I've gotten since I've been here.
sure not.
Yeah.
Is there a blessing to this hour?
Yeah. All right. So that's, you know, the first assumption thing, that one doesn't necessarily follow from the other. I mean, if you just, you know, start with God, God gives Torah, right? Well, you know, leads you also to the next question of, well, how do you know God gave the Torah? What is your source for that? Simple question. This is not a trick question.
Sure.
Exactly. How do you know God gave the Torah? The Torah tells you. And that is a line of reasoning which I find very troubling if you try to say, you know, proving something for yourself. And to give two examples of why this is difficult, take source number 6. This is Book of John 14.
Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself. That where I am, there you may also, there you may be also. And whither I go, you know the way, and the way you know. Thomas saith unto him, Lord, we know not whither thou goest, and how can we know the way? Jesus saith unto him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me.
Yeah. Now, you might find that it's weird that I would include a passage from the New Testament here, but part of it is to illustrate the point where if you're going to argue that, you know, God gave the Torah because the Torah said so, you can logically extend that to pretty much any book. Meaning, what would really be the difference between being Jewish and being Christian other than, well, the New Testament says so, therefore it must be true. It's the same type of, argument that people are giving. And for comedic effect, please take source number 7.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Mm. Harry stretched out his hand at last to take the yellowish envelope, addressed in emerald green to Mr. H. Potter. The floor, hut on the rock, the sea. He pulled out the letter and read, Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, Headmaster Albus Dumbledore. Order of Merlin, First Class Grand Sorcerer, Chief Warlock, Supreme Mogwump, International Confederation of Wizards. Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Please enclose the list, find and close the list of all necessary books and equipment. Term begins on September 1st. We await your OWL by no later than July 31st. Yours sincerely, Minerva
McGonagall.
McGonagall.
Haven't even seen the movie.
I hate to admit it.
Oh, man.
Deputy headmistress.
Now, the point here is that, you know, he said it's partially for comedic effect, but it does serve a certain point here, which is if you're going to use a book to prove the validity of itself, then there's no reason not to assume the existence of the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, or to say that any of these other things have existed. Or in other words, unless you a priori believe in the divine authorship or divine significance of this particular book, you might as well be reading Harry Potter. And that's not, you know, a dig at, you know, any other religions as much as, you know, if you happen to believe that this word is, pardon, you know, the idiom here, gospel truth, well then fine, but if you don't, you don't. And then, yeah,
that's
any thoughts on that?
Point that, I mean, Harry Potter is not telling you that there is a school with Dr. Wizardry. It's a story, whereas the Bible and the Torah are telling you that this is what it is.
You know, I could just as easily, this is only one excerpt
yes.
here, right? Look.
There's other self-referential.
Yes, and there are plenty of descriptions about, oh, here's what Hogwarts looks like, the implication being that this place exists, even though it's clearly meant to be be, you know, a fantasy. And people might be very upset, you know, by that analogy. But the truth is, if you are an atheist or an otherwise non-believer, the Bible could just as easily be a science fiction. I mean, you take the books of the Bible and compare to Harry Potter, both have sold really well, both have spawned movies of varying quality. Yes. But that doesn't mean, you know, by itself, that one is going to be more intrinsically accurate than the next. Right? Yeah.
Finish your thought. I have a question after. It's just...
No, go ahead. Ask the question.
It seems a little bit frustrating to me because we're talking about God and the Torah, and I feel like one of the fundamentals of Judaism nowadays is also the oral texts and how...
Oh, we haven't gotten there yet.
Are we going to touch on that? Oh, yes.
Question. It's a wonderful question about, like, where the oral tradition does, in fact, come in. And yes. There'll be a whole set on, like, how halakha works, too. But we haven't gotten there yet. Because, like, you know, before we even get that, we have to first understand what's the relationship with the actual, you know, Torah itself. Because rabbinic authority would have to be justified somehow. Maybe that's a result of faith. Maybe that comes elsewhere. But it has to come from someplace. And then we also get to talk about things like rabbinic authority. So consider that a preview.
Do you... I'm sorry if you're finished.
No, I'm taking it in. You go.
Okay.
You don't think that there are other possibilities that are not... Let's say, you know, like most people get Torah, they get it right, they get it with their life and with doing the halachic, by doing mitzvot and things like that, and gradually learn Torah.
Yeah.
And so, you don't think that the that they're not intermeshed more than that, like the whole life and the God as being like an underpinning of this kind of life that sort of pins together all this, all the mitzvot and the Torah and all this kind of stuff. So if somebody's committed to that life.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, most synagogues, they don't discuss whether people believe in God or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's basically what you do that mm-hmm. people care about. So you don't think the fact that all this stuff is imbued with God, that sort of like works hand in hand with his existence for people. Not that there's an independent faith in God outside of the Torah. You know what I'm saying?
No, didn't quite follow that.
That's just as strong as you're saying that it's kind of a weak link that you're just getting it from the book. But there's another possibility is that you're living a life. And so you're accepting the notion of you're accepting.
Now, when
God,
you say living a life, where did that stuff come from? Meaning the idea that here's the stuff that you're supposed to be doing.
Where does it come from?
Yes.
From the Torah.
Well, there you go.
No, but I mean, where does it come from in a life? It comes from your community, basically.
Okay.
And so you have this whole community built up around this idea. So you don't know. I mean, you really don't know whether it's independent of the whole community and the whole. That's not saying it's light or it's frivolous or anything like that. It's like a whole life to people. I mean,
so you're saying just even
life.
Living in a Jewish way, without really getting into theology of what it is that you believe or not, maybe even
The truth is that most people don't get into theology. Even very Orthodox people don't get into, you know.
Well, that's kind of what we're doing here.
No, I know. I know, but you're saying that you can't, that it doesn't make any sense without an independent... belief in God without Torah.
An independent belief in God. Well, if you have the Torah, right, you can reasonably argue, what is it that... I see. So, in theory, we'd like to offer the possibility here of, you know, you have this book that tells you that God wants you to do certain things. Now, you might not necessarily believe in God, but for other ways you feel that...
But it also describes a whole life that a lot of people have been living since they were kids.
Okay, so it's
it provides room for, like, you know, it's not the kind of thing where it's just like it's an argument against authority. Once something cracks, because there's a lot of room for argument, so it's like an all encompassing thing that allows even argument and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't like lose your faith in living this way, because like you notice one day that like a bad man does get punished or something like that, because there's a lot of discussion.
So see it as a guideline for how to live a life that doesn't necessarily need to be dependent on the existence of God being the commander, but rather this is something that you were brought up with, and it's almost like a blueprint of the way that you wish to live.
No, but God is the commander through this blueprint that you read in there that you're using for your life. So you accept God as the commander in that way. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah.
But it's,
I think,
it's,
but I'm not sure the nuance
really
you're trying to make.
Integrally, tied in. I'm not saying it's constructivist kind of thing. I'm saying that it's like a different category that I'm just now trying to. It's just occurring to me right now.
Oh, okay. I'm not really sure I picked up all the nuances there. The main point that I'm trying to get across today is that if you can reduce it into one like principle here, before you even talk to God, you can say like even putting it in one word is. Fundamental of Judaism being the divinity of the Torah.
Uh-huh.
Right? And in those three words. Because yes, that does assume God, and it does assume the Torah, but it also helps us solve that little dichotomy there of where do you get what first? Because if you assume the divinity of the Torah, now, and I say assume, and we put that as a matter of faith, because if the Torah isn't divine, well then, or at least doesn't in some way represent the will of God, and you know, if you people are interested in here, we may be able to give a special class just on biblical criticism type stuff. Mm-hmm. But in some level, you know, if this isn't divine, well then, what's the point of any of this? You're basically trying to rely on the authority of a book. And anything that you, as you mentioned at the very beginning of the class, if you want to just, you know, talk about expositions on what is God, well, most of what we, you know, as Jews know or think about God are based on verses in the Bible. So unless those verses in the Bible are somehow of divine origin, then it would be no different than someone just making stuff up and saying, oh, here's what I think God is. That would have no more value than anything else. So what I'm trying to do here isn't really to argue against, you know, the existence of God or Torah, yeah. But to rather say that in terms of, you know, thinking like a programmer for a second, dependencies uh-huh. on like the main thing isn't really to split God and Torah, but rather to realize that little circle there in that most of what we know about God is from the Torah. But unless that Torah is divine from God, then none of what's there is going to matter. So the real core is divinity of the Torah, that in some way the Bible represents the word and all extended the will of God. Mm-hmm. All right. And at least, you know, let's focus on here the Old Testament. If people want, you know, to get into differences between Judaism and Christianity, that'll be much, 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 much later. Mm-hmm. All right. Because, you know, you can say, well, once you believe in, you know, the divinity of the Torah, you know, we could argue, well, what other beliefs then follow? Right? So, you know, when we get to things like mitzvot, right? God commands you do X, Y, or Z, right? Well, do you have to do them? Well, if God, you know, does this and all these things happen, well then, sure, because it actually somehow matters that you do this stuff. If you don't really believe in the existence of God and you do this for cultural reasons or nostalgic reasons, well then, there's no real benefit whether or not you do them or not do them. Or just for aesthetic purposes or spreading, you know, Jewish culture. You can spread Jewish culture in any number of ways. But that's not really, you know, the point of the Bible. The point of the Bible is a whole bunch of laws and details, which if they do represent the will of God, well then, you kind of have to take what God says seriously, ostensibly.
I guess so. But I mean, it's like, my problem is that we really, and we're told this by several people like Maimonides, that we really don't know what we're talking about. we get this notion of God through the Torah, and this is the notion that's imbued with Torah, mm-hmm. because and the sage will say that that's the way it has to be presented to us, but we don't know. You know, and we don't know what it really means. We can't really comprehend what it really means.
Mm.
And a lot of the, so if you're saying that it's underpinned by that, I mean, there's a process going on when you're accepting the divinity there, but I really think it's through the through living a certain way and through the book, because it says that you're a holy people.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a practice to become holy,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you're making a connection with God, but you really don't understand it.
If I'm understanding, and maybe the way that you phrased it, that the way that you demonstrated here isn't through thought as much as through action. Is that your point, or did
That's
I miss it?
That's a big part of the point.
Okay.
The other part of the point is that you're not really making a statement when you say you believe in God or you don't believe in God. But you're making more of a statement when you live a life according to Torah,
mm-hmm.
because you're vying to be holy. You're struggling to sort of like get close to the divine.
So I think that's well said. And I think in subsequent weeks we're going to explore some of these ideas of how God is represented in the Bible itself. And there's one point which I'm not sure if I've made it here or elsewhere, but I'll do it again. You know, if you look at what God actually wants you to do, mm-hmm. or to live. Most of the commandments, yes, they presuppose the existence of God, uh-huh. obviously, but are more concerned with what is it that you do, uh-huh. as opposed to believe in these theological minutia.
Right.
That's a class for another time.
Uh-huh. That's a thing.
Sure. Any thoughts? Or just taking stuff in?
Taking it in.
Taking it in. All right. Any thoughts? Yeah. Okay.
It's spreading.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, this is. I'm not used to such a conciliatory audience. Usually, I'm used to people like yelling at me for one thing or another.
But it's. I mean, you're talking about from the programmer standpoint. To me, I'm looking at only. I'm not looking at the big picture, because my problem is that when you talk about faith and all these other things, there's a much larger flowchart that. I feel needs to
flesh
out before I can make a
statement. Oh, we haven't fleshed we haven't fleshed anything out yet. I mean, this is just.
Yeah.
But you have to start at the very basic at the really small building blocks. And if you don't assume the divinity of the Torah, and I'm putting that in also to illustrate that this is, I would say, a core matter of faith. It's not something that you're going to be able to produce as a matter of fact. That this is somehow historical or factual, or that it is any more or less divine than others, no matter what the Bible quotes people might try to come up with.
Yeah. But it's just a matter of you're doing this on faith, but you're also going into the traits of God on faith.
Well, we haven't even gotten into traits. All that we've said so far is that this book is of somehow divine origin. Once you make that assumption, then we can start extrapolating a little bit more and start taking it in different things. But if it's not of divine origin, if you haven't at least set that premise up, none of Judaism is really going to make that much sense.
But wouldn't you assess what's in the book before you made that leap? I mean, to me, when you get married to someone, you kind of the pros and the cons, and then you weigh it out, and you. That sounds really negative, but it's
we went back to the covenant.
We were given that choice.
You said
you were given that choice.
No, we were not given that choice.
Depends on midrashim. This is actually the type of stuff we've been talking about in the Sunday class on covenant.
But what I'm saying is, when you're saying take this as, I take this as faith. Obviously, I'm here. I'm a practicing Jew.
Yeah.
But when you say let's take a step back and read it, so I'm like, okay, well, I see your circle, but what's in that circle is, the content of that book, which goes
mm-hmm.
into stories, it goes into...
So you're saying in terms of the way one approaches, the religion, yes, it's probably going to be more experiential. Because otherwise, I don't think you've got any atheist that walks around, gets in his head and says, I am now going to make the conscious decision to accept the belief that the Old and the New Testament are of divine origin and have divine sanctity to it, such that I will now become a practicing Christian. That's not how people operate. I don't disagree that that's not the human religious experience, right? One religious experience would be, well, simply you were born and raised as a Jew, and you know, you had this stuff hammered into you from a kid, and now it's almost second nature. And if you come to Judaism, I don't think anyone just automatically, I mean, well, maybe someone gets like a flash of inspiration, like, I need this, or like, this must be the way, without some prior exposure to the Bible or what's in it. And then maybe something resonates with you or not that might cause the faith to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't think that those two are mutually exclusive at all.
Huh.
I mean, one is an experiential approach. Is how does one get to Judaism? How does one get to experience that sort of faith? Versus, you know, if you're actually going to say, like, you know, once someone actually does become Jewish, what are the things that are actually underlying it?
Right, even though
that wasn't how it was built.
It seems to me that we're dealing, or the conversation seems to always... Like, I'm trying to look at it from a factual basis to make my decision about making this leap of faith.
Well, not always. We only had 2 weeks.
It's a conversation.
Yeah, that's right.
But at the end of the day, it always comes back to this emotional, spiritual faith. And to me, I know that I'm going to get to that point, and I know that, you know, I'm happy with that. But if I'm looking at it from a factual point, I mean... There's a lot in that little category over there that I would be.
Oh yeah, and this is all stuff that's going. But this is all stuff. But this is all stuff that we, you know, are going to have to spend time to flesh out. We clearly aren't going to be able to do it, you know, in a week. I think we are going to get, you know, get to a lot of the concrete ideas that you know that people might wrestle with in terms of.
But you have to acknowledge this, or can they be almost projects in parallel? In other words. You're making an assumption that until proven otherwise, this exists. And at the same time, start looking at, well, if God is omnipotent and all these other omni words, you know, I'll do that to an English person, what took him so long to come out with the Oral Torah? Well, they could forget something and... Like,
all right, well, we've got a while before...
But that's what I'm saying. Like, couldn't we make these assumptions in parallel instead of saying, by week two, we're making this... leap of faith
Sure.
I guess that's what
no.
I thought that you were cutting off a whole bunch.
Oh, no. Again, this is only week two.
No, I know.
Right?
No,
and I'm just trying to set up, a certain building block here. I mean, even before you get to the oral Torah, right, or the oral interpretive tradition, right, all of that is still going to be predicated on the divinity of the Torah.
Well, you're saying that right away.
Yes.
Me too.
I most certainly am. Now, granted...
No, but we don't really know what that means yet.
That's why I'm saying, like, I was...
Okay, so you're right. From the outset, I'm trying to be as abstract as possible here.
You should accomplish
that. Well, thank you. But it's important to have that abstraction, you know, down from the outset. Said, so that when we do go through the rest, you can say, well, you know, here are the things that people are going to base this on. And if you're going to have, I think, a reasonable discussion of Judaism, especially trying to have this thing of fact versus faith, is to realize where are going to be the assumptions that you can't prove, but once you're going to assume them from the discussion of dialogue, what necessarily has to follow? And then what are the limits there of, well, you know, if you assume the Bible is, you know, the will of God, and, you know, or... And here's what the Bible says, therefore, meaning that the Bible is the will of God, then how do you handle all these other interpretations? Right? Because how do you handle something like ayin tachet ayin, an eye for an eye, where according to, you know, the words, right, would mean one thing, according to Jewish law, means something else entirely. And those are things that we are, I promise you, are going to discuss issues like that, too.
And then we'll come back to this.
It's not that we'll come back to this, right? We're not going to, I mean, the only thing that... Yes, I mean, the one thing that we're going to come back to is, you know, yeah, we are going to assume the divine authorship, you know, divinity of the Torah. What are the implications of that, you know, as we're going to go forward? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, and I know I'm going to fast forward here almost months, right, if someone says, you have to follow a particular rabbi, right, the implication is, skipping through a whole bunch of logical steps, and we will go up through that change, is that God wants you to follow this rabbi, or doing so somehow fulfills the will of God.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
you'll notice there's a whole bunch of middle stuff in the middle. No, there's a whole bunch of stuff in the middle there, right? And that's the stuff that we're going to try to get to, but I'm trying to... Yes! Well, like I said, telegraphing months ahead.
That's also like a... You're talking about free will and everything.
I didn't say that... Look, the reason why I chose this as a series is because it's going to take a long time. Yeah. It was just a one-off.
But are we still doing systematic checks? Like, you know, when you do math and you make a bunch of assumptions, at the end of the day, you go back and you say, does A equal B?
Yeah.
If it equals it, then you do the next step. And I just...
Well,
that was my one
okay. So the answer, is sometimes, right? But the question is, what are going to be those checks? If you want to say, like, I need to prove the divinity, the divine authorship of the Torah, that is not something that I am personally able to prove by any scientific method.
Right.
However,
you look and see if everything kind of, if there's any like outlier that just makes you have to rethink your theory. Not to say that that case isn't true, but. Kind of restructure.
Oh, yes. And for that, we're actually, you know, and that will come up when we get to questions of, like, strategies. Like, what happens if you do find an apparent contradiction in the Torah? Right? If you do, you can either say, well, either God is not infallible, mm-hmm. or, you know, and we'll go through, like, a whole bunch of possibilities, right, when you find something like this. Right? Some people might want to apply Occam's razor, like, you know, the simplest thing there. Yeah. Right? You know, maybe there was, you know, some error in transmission, right? Maybe that, you know, like I said, you know, maybe theologically, maybe God isn't infallible, or possibly, you know, you have, user error, the Bacher des Etzers, they say, whoever, copied it did it incorrectly, or, you know, possibly that's why you have the interpretive tradition, and maybe that's where it comes in, and how you have the harmonizing of such conflicts, and what do you do with what we might call apparent difficult verses? You know, and a strategy, and what makes a verse difficult. You know, you could say, well, it's difficult because it contradicts certain assumptions that you might have held. Well, where did you get those assumptions? Probably got them from teachers. Where did they get it from? Were those teachers, you know, correct in any way? Or were they making stuff up? And, you know, and I've experienced this, you know, myself every now and again, of, you know, teachers that will blindly just ignore inconvenient sources, even if they're biblical, simply because they happen to be inconvenient, or will reinterpret and reread verses because they see things that don't fit in with their concept of what the theology ought to be, right? Which is a whole other approach as well.
So, with this initial assumption, which we're going to be checking systematically, we're going to be looking at the context of the Torah and its relationship to God. And then we're going to, at the same time, be looking at the oral Torah and traditions, or interpretations and traditions, and then also the new modern.
Every time that we're going to read a verse, we're going to have to interpret it in some way.
Right.
So there's no way of getting around the interpretive aspect.
Right, but what I'm saying is, what I'm saying is that we're having one conversation about three subcategories.
Mm.
We're having this conversation, then once we make that assumption, we're going to study the Torah and God and the relationships between them and all that stuff. Then we're going to take it a step further and see how the old oral tradition and stuff like that relates. And then we're going to look at modern rabbinical...
Yeah.
And then at the same time, with each one of these things, checking back and making sure all of our assumptions square away, that we continue to make that.
Yeah, pretty much.
But one second.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, that seems like a very good summary.
Is that fair for me to say that? Like, cause this topic is great, but I just don't have any initial comments on that.
Okay. Well, because I'm not sure how much more you can comment on this. The only point that I try to make, the only thing that I want people to understand is why the assumption of the divinity of the Torah is necessary and why it has to be in that way. Because if you're going to try to define God, if you're trying to define the authenticity of the Torah by itself, right, you kind of get stuck there. But the only way that you know stuff about God, or at least vis-a-vis Judaism, is through the Torah. That was just the main point of, you know, today that I really wanted to get across.
This might be a little bit out of context. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Kelly.
So, it seems like there's more than a little bit of this that can't be approached logically and isn't about proof. I mean, Maimonides pretty early on says there are 13 things you absolutely have to have faith in as part of being a Jew,
and we'll
these are two of them.
Right. Well, you know,
does everybody accept?
No. That was one of the classes we gave in the Politics of Exclusion class, which was like, you know, based off of Mark Shapiro's wonderful book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, where he went through, well, you know, here might be the Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, and here are a bunch of, you know, fairly prominent traditional rabbis that disagreed with, you know, all or parts of, you know, things that Maimonides had to say.
But, you know, it's like if we're not taking that as for granted, then we could basically spend our lives kind of picking apart, like, well, what's the point of it if it's not divine? It's just what, you know, some old white men in Eastern Europe thought, and maybe they're wrong.
Exactly. And what I, you
so
know,
what are we doing here?
Well, that's exactly. And, you know, in the first week I tried setting up, you know, in the distinctions of fact and faith. And I don't think having faith in something is bad, you know, giving that value judgment. But I think we need to realize that it is a matter of faith. And that if you do try talking to someone and says, well, you know, how do you know God gave the Torah? And the answer is, well, the Torah says so. Why then you can't take that as a matter of fact, and why there is a logical problem with such an argument. But that's an argument you're going to find from a lot of people. I'm saying that it's not really an argument. This is something which has to be taken as a matter of faith. Now, why should you take it as a matter of faith? That's going to be much longer in, you know.
I mean, I have to say that you cannot just, like, say that it has to be. I mean, we can assume it for the discussion, but we should return to it. I mean, because of the fact, A, how do you step outside the perspective of Torah if you're a Jew?
What do you mean?
You're saying that you have to believe in it independently of the fact of Torah.
No, I'm saying you have to. The point that I'm, you know, saying that you would have to believe is, you know, for the purposes of a Fundamentals of Judaism class, would be the divinity of the Torah. That would be the point. In which case, you know, which sort of solves the, you know, which solves the little circle that we have up there.
I mean, the thing is, if you're talking about faith in the first place, a circular, you know, if it's going to bother you that, you know, all the conundrums that come with having an all-powerful being, why can't it, you know, it doesn't have to bother you more to have that kind of circular thing going on.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I see. Yes and no.
I mean, you're basically doing something on faith.
Yeah.
Which, so you could accept a circular version of faith as much as you can, and independent.
But
like
at least
I have this.
Well, sure, accepting that. Sure, absolutely. But at least acknowledge that you're doing it as a matter of faith, and not that it's some great cosmic logic behind it.
Right. There's no proof.
Yeah.
What you're saying?
Yes. It's not so much, you know, what I'm trying to disagree with here, or you'll see this, I guess, as it comes out, isn't just so much a matter of content, but a matter of an approach, a thought process to religion of, you know, reevaluating these fundamentals and what does it mean for something to make sense and not beyond what you might get from, you know, your typical introduction class of God, right? So yes. So even if we end up at the exact same place, I do think the process matters because that's going to enable us to have much better discussions and a much better understanding and also a more honest understanding.
Yeah.
And I have no problem acknowledging that it's, you know, in large part my own reaction to when I hear colleagues or other people say things that just really don't make sense and don't want to accept that it doesn't make logical sense when they're presenting it as rational. Like, okay, yes, there are going to be things that you're not going to be able to prove. I happen to be okay with that, right? But I think we should also be okay admitting that, as opposed to try coming from the perspective like, you know, this has to be a matter of, you know, absolute qualifiable fact scientific, because it's not going to work. And I think if you try also, and I don't know who else has tried it this way, but you know, my own sense, and again, this is only personal experiential, is that if you try to build up a system of faith on flawed ideas, you know, then if someone really challenges them and someone really thinks about them, there could be pretty easy to unravel.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easier to unravel somebody saying, God doesn't exist, and if you because you're cutting out, you're excluding like a huge portion of Jews. That's my big problem.
No, but
there's a lot of people who just like they struggle with it all their lives. They don't have what you're calling this perfect faith And they keep, a lot of them are observant.
This is not
and
a matter
of excluding
that. Oh, I haven't excluded
that. It sounds like that. You're saying,
you're saying
Judaism falls apart unless the press falls apart. That's what it sounds like.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
If you don't have
the intent wasn't so much. So the intent here isn't to be critical of people who do things differently or people. Well, actually, you know what? Yeah. Okay. It's not.
You're saying point blank that the whole thing doesn't make sense without this perfect faith in the divinity of Torah. That's independent of.
Well, okay. All right. Well, thank you for that point of clarification. So, in theory, you could be doing this stuff for a whole lot of other reasons.
No, it's not a reason thing. I mean, we're talking about faith here.
So let's say you haven't,
we're talking about life, a whole life. We're talking about life, based on reasons.
Yeah. There are certain things that we're going to do exclusively on faith, and if we try and make sense out of it, we're never going to succeed. We have no idea why we have anything to do with a red heifer. Why we can't plant certain crops next to each other. We just have to assume that the reasons might be.
I want to address your point.
Can I just say one thing? The reason might be, what is the added value of this that gets you, if you think something is good to do, okay? You're Jewish, you think it's good to do these things. Do you have to come to say, okay, this is not, I have to decide whether I believe in God or I shouldn't do this stuff?
So, that can be something we'll get to in terms of the whole mitzvah shalom, lo lishma, just doing the action. You use the term perfect faith. I'm not sure the faith has to necessarily be perfect. I would say this,
that's why I'm saying
okay.
We didn't really talk about
so,
what faith
well, 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 also let's look at the, practice part. Someone does something because they think it's good in some way. I guess whenever you do anything, right, there's going to be some reason why you do it.
You're thinking it's better to do it than not do it.
Yeah, better to do it than not do it. Now, there's going to be some reason behind it. Mm-hmm. Are there Jewish atheists who just do things because of, that's what Judaism is?
Atheism.
No, I'm taking one. Okay.
Agnosticism is.
But even agnosticism, when you're trying to debate, what it, and we'll actually get to that in terms of, nature of God, really there it is. But let's say someone's an atheist. Let's take an extreme example.
Yeah.
Right, someone is an atheist, would say, well, I'm going to do this for, even though I know for certain that there is no God because that there's some cultural reason there. Even if you're an agnostic, right, you are still, by definition, you are uncertain, but you're still seeking out, you're still searching.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you could have in the back of your head, maybe this is, maybe this isn't. I would say even that maybe would still go up in there because the reason compelling you to do this, essentially be somehow, on some level, God desires this based on what God said in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
On some, it might be distant, it might be abstract, but I think that kernel, that nugget, is still going to be underlying if anyone does a mitzvah with a religious intent, religious as opposed to a purely secular intent, which does happen every now and again.
People do it if you want to be holy. You don't have to know what that means.
Exactly. You're absolutely right.
You want to reach the video, you have to know what
you are absolutely right. You don't. Yes. This doesn't mean you have to have everything concretized and try to free from it. It's not just concrete. Just at some level, right? It means that not only just God, but there's a divinity part of the Torah. And it's not just that there is a God, but God gave the Torah, and this Torah represents the will of God. That's it. Now, even if it might be a small component there that's compelling you, but that part is still going to be there. The only way it wouldn't be is if you take a pure atheistic approach to say, because otherwise, let's say you do believe in the existence of God, but not necessarily in the Torah, well then, what would make the Jewish rituals any superior to any other rituals from another religion?
oh, I don't want to be that different.
Yeah.
Well, as you say, I mean, if you have a less, if you're taking it from an agnostic position or a position that you do this because this is what Judaism is, and not because it's particular faith in God.
Well, you say what Judaism is. Elaborate on what you mean by that.
Yeah, this is what the Jewish community says that you should be doing.
Yeah, that's a whole separate discussion there.
Okay. Yeah.
Whole slew of assumptions there. And you'll notice, I mean, this might be the fundamentals of Judaism. The fundamentals of Judaism isn't Judaism. It's, you know, God and Torah. And, you know, as we'll see, I'm going to flesh out my own thing here, that Torah is a lot more important than Judaism. And that statement is going to make a lot more sense as we move along. Yeah.
And I don't know what you were saying. You're saying that you're not saying it's what community is, and I'm not sure why. I don't understand the concession that you were making to him.
It wasn't a concession as much as if someone, let's say you have a person who does one of the commandments, mm-hmm. okay? For it doesn't matter what denomination, right? Just someone does something, let's say it's pick up the lulav on Sukkot. All right. Now, unless someone is a pure agnostic, somewhere in their back of their head means like, oh, you know, God wants me to do this in some way or somehow, like either, you know, pass through generations, whoever it is. But how do you know ultimately what's the core source of shaking a lulav on Sukkot? Well, that's going to be the Torah. Right? Why do you care about the Torah? Like, how does that represent the will of God? Well, poof, divinity of the Torah in some way. That's it. And that wasn't the only, it wasn't really a concession as much as an explanation in that this, you know, whole thing about the divinity of the Torah isn't going to be, it's not that it's not a matter of, you know, having perfect faith in this, but underlying pretty much any religious activity that we do as Jews is going to be that assumption. And it's not just in God, it's not just in the Torah, specifically in the divinity of the Torah.
But if you're saying that it's not perfect faith, then where? But it's also not community. Then where does that come from?
Oh, this is only week two. Yeah. We got plenty of stuff to do. Wow, I hope.
Week three will be jam packed.
Well, okay. Well, no, I mean, the truth is, the questions that you're raising, you know, I think are pretty useful. In terms of how to do this, I think for subsequent weeks, now that, I guess like for my own, you know, logical thing, I had to at least establish, you know, why we're going to be studying, you know, the Torah, you know, that we are making this assumption. For subsequent weeks, I will do my best to make it a lot more text heavy so that, you know, we won't be dealing with as many abstractions. We'll actually be dealing with words on a page. But, you know, even one of the things that we'll get to, you know, and why I wanted to do this is, I can make up source sheets, and I can quote a lot of stuff in Hebrew and do my own poor translations of them in English, but, you know, we have to justify every step of the way, why do we care about the source, right? So, great, I can quote the... And, yes, you could say take this for granted, but since this is a fundamental course, I don't want to take stuff for granted, right? So, I'm okay with having the assumption as, you know, the Torah being, you know, divine origin, or representing divine will, and now we can take it from there as we start quoting, let's say, Sukkot. And more than, you know, once we, you know, start getting more stuff there, I think things might become a little bit more concretized. And all, as always, like, feel free to, like, pepper with more questions or requests for topics or different angles. And also, like, when you mentioned about rabbinic authority, like, before we open up a Gemara, a fundamental question is, why should we care about the Gemara?
I want to go past that, though. I mean, like, for me...
Well, we're going to get there, but...
I think for me, the big points that I wanted out of this was that I want to keep coming back to this. Like,
yeah.
With every step that we go through, does that still...
Yeah, we're going to...
Do we still make this assumption, or do we now have a systemic issue, or a...
Which and
problem
those, but those are questions that that we will get back to.
And I want to also go from there.
Yeah.
When we start talking about, you know, the Industrial Revolution, if you will.
Yeah.
And how that starts getting incorporated into Judaism.
I don't know what you mean by that, but
more issues like
yeah,
that.
There's going to be a subsetting here that will take quite some time on how does halacha. Well, it's going to be more of how does halacha work.
Right.
Right.
But not just Gemara. I mean, like there's. That's what I was saying with the three
but
steps.
But even your question there, not just Gemara, assumes what part Gemara has in the halachic process. We're going to do all this. It's fantastic. Going to take time. Yeah. I'm not going anywhere. Yeah.
Why do we need to study or justify or in any way explain what it is we do in the context of Indian...
Oh, you missed. You came in after we did all that.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll get the notes from the neighbor.
Yeah. All right. So, next week, I'll, you know, think a little more concretized on... okay, we'll do stuff next week that's going to be more text-heavy. And we're going to focus a lot more, you know, like we're doing in the, you know, the covenantal class. First we focus, or in the chosenness class. It's not really covenant class, because that's only just like one component of chosenness. But we've been focusing on covenants. But we're going to first start in the biblical sources, and then, you know, progressive, once we have like, oh, here's a biblical idea, then we can say, well, what's the deal with the oral law, and then move down, you know, and discuss, well, what are the Gemara, and then say, well, how did Gemara try dealing with some of these? Although, the truth is, I might even cheat once or twice there, and throw in a Gemara and say, you know, just trust me that Gemara is going to be somewhat important, but we haven't justified it yet, but we will. Mm-hmm. But those are, a question which ought to come up whenever you cite a source, trying to think, well, why is this a source that we need to care about, or at least why do we need to care about this source more than the other and give certain weight to one over the other?
So can we add to the source sheet?
Yeah.
Just as the weeks continue and we continue to make assumptions, just... Instead of this being point one, the references, make point one assumptions to date.
Oh, maybe.
And point two being
the
references.
Wow, it's a lot to keep track of.
I agree.
Wow.
Just that's my concern is I don't want to keep stating what assumptions I'm making. Because I mean, everyone here is in a shul. We're all here because we have some kind of faith. No one's attacking the faith. It's just a matter of, you know, if we're going to learn about why we were able to make this jump of faith, I'd like to see at the end of 2 months' time, 3 months' time. What assumptions are we up to now? Is it two pages? Is it
pages? That's a pretty good idea, and it might help me keep this a little bit better organized and on point here.
Great.
All right. So right now, then, we got one, which is Divinity of the Torah, and we'll might get more in subsequent weeks, and we also might get to that whole necessary and plausible, and saying what are the things that you have to say and what are the things that you could say and what are the range of the plausible opinions.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's good.
Yeah, I like that idea. All right. Have a great week.